Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is observed today. Ceremonies will be held in towns big and small, and even where there are no ceremonies, lots of people get the day off. Our guest should be out of the office today, too, but he joins us to talk about his research into the civil rights and black power movements. Curtis Austin is an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon. He is steeped in the history of the civil rights movement and the movements that grew out of it. Dr. Austin's first book is called Up Against the Wall, Violence and the Making and Unmaking of the Black Panther Party. He's our guest in this month's Curious segment, Research Meets Radio. Curtis Austin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I understand from watching your TEDx talk that your own research actually got you labeled a felon. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
What happened?
I was stopped at an airport in Jackson, Mississippi for carrying 25 copies of the book you just described and was questioned by the FBI for several hours.
So it was 25 copies of your own book, not that you had all these books from the 60s or something.
No, that's right. No, this book was from 2007, and it was the only thing I had in my suitcase. I was actually going to buy a car in, of all places, Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa. Had a one-way ticket, and that didn't look right to the airport authorities, so they decided to call the authorities.
Were you on the border of getting labeled a terrorist or something because of this? I mean, what happened?
I absolutely was labeled a terrorist, a felon, as you mentioned. And it took, I guess, 2 years to get the designation removed from my record.
And that time, were you on the no-fly list or something?
It wasn't the no-fly list, but every single time I went to the airport, I was pulled to the side as the random person to be thoroughly examined. So I was allowed to fly, but it was very difficult during that period.
Wow. So let's get to the meat of the stuff that you actually have been researching all these years. Black power and Black Panthers probably get tangled up in people's minds. They are not synonymous, are they?
They are not synonymous. The Black Power movement is much larger than the Black Panther Party, although the Black Panther Party is part and parcel of that movement. Black power comes about in the mid-1960s. Some people say 66 at the James Meredith March when Nick leader Stokely Carmichael yelled out those famous words. But the movement itself was an action on the part of activists during this period to declare that they would focus on Black history, Black culture, and self-determination, and not so much getting laws passed to recognize Black people as human beings.
Because, I mean, what marks the difference? I mean, what was the approach they were choosing not to observe?
Well, certainly one of the huge differences between, say, the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power Movement was an open declaration that Blacks would not rely solely on nonviolence as a strategy or a tactic, even though I would say about 95% of all Black Power groups did not have one way or another, this outlook on violence or nonviolence. The Black Panther Party certainly was one of those organizations that decided that nonviolence was passe and that they would be for self-defense of individuals and of the Black community in general.
Well, we did talk to Bobby Seale, one of the Panther founders, here on the program 3 years ago. He talked about seeing Martin Luther King telling a crowd about bakeries that would not hire people of color.
He says Wonder Bread refuses. He says we're going to have to boycott them, and we want to boycott them so consistently and so profoundly, we want to make Wonder Bread wonder where the money went. And this audience, 7,000 people, I'm one individual. I'm totally inspired by this guy, Martin Luther King. And that's what kicked it for me.
And so there's Bobby Seale saying Martin Luther King himself was a great inspiration for him, and yet he decided over time that this was not the way to go.
Certainly with the nonviolent tactic, but if one examines the history of the Black Panther Party, they used the tactic of a boycott many, many times with great success.
And, you know, the Black Panthers, so much of the imagery, and we'll talk a little more about this as we go on, but, you know, the Beyonce and all that stuff, but women were the majority of the members of the party, it turns out.
That is actually one of the most one of the largest myths of the Black Panther Party, that there were these black men going around the country looking for white people to shoot. Certainly nothing could be further from the truth. But the other thing is, in fact, that many more women joined the Black Panther Party than did men. And back about 1970, the majority of the leadership of the Black Panther Party was made up of women.
So why do you suppose, I mean, there are certainly issues to consider here about who's in charge of the media, but why do you suppose the image has come down through all these years, that it was large, scary black men, at least as portrayed in the general culture?
Well, I think that there's this notion that black men are to be feared, and because of what happens so often to black men in this country, the media paints this negative image so that the majority of Americans will imagine that they deserve the kind of treatment that they receive. It's very hard for people to imagine that women, a large group of women, were so effective at starting free breakfast programs, free health clinics, engaging in all a bunch of shootouts with the police, changing the way schools educate children, changing the way doctors and the medical profession provide health care. It's just, to a lot of people, I would think unimaginable that it was women who were at the forefront of these kinds of very significant social movements. So I think that it has everything to do with making the U.S. public okay with the exclusion, the discrimination, the incarceration that has become part and parcel of the lives of black and brown men throughout the United States.
Curtis Austin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon and expert on the history of the black power and civil rights movements. And he's our guest in this month's edition of Curious, our joint venture with the University of Oregon in Research Meets Radio. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, to get in by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, Curtis, the most visible signs of the Black Panthers to people who did not live in the communities where they were extant were black leather and berets and guns. I mean, to the people in the community, were the goals of the Black Panthers always abundantly clear?
Oh, certainly. To the people in the community, they were crystal clear, because the fact of the matter is the Black Panther Party nationwide had fewer than 5,000 people. So as quiet as it's kept, the majority of the people who did the work of these programs that I just alluded to would be community members. The Panthers call them community workers. You would have people who wouldn't quite have the gumption, the desire to join the organization because it was repressed so heavily. But they were more than willing to cook breakfast for these programs, more than willing to provide money for medical supplies, more than willing to sell the Black Panther Party newspaper, to knock on doors, to get petition signs, that kind of thing. So the people inside of the communities were crystal clear about what the Panthers' goals were.
You know, you've mentioned a couple times now the free breakfast, and this is really something that caught on in all of the country, was realizing that, hey, poor kids don't do well in school when they're hungry and can't focus on their work, and so the Black Panthers set up the breakfast program to address that directly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's one of the other things that helps when you study this history. It helps to dispel this myth that the Black Panther Party was this avidly racist organization. Because when you think about having the ability to feed people, you obviously need food. Almost all the members in the Black Panther Party had no job. They were full-time revolutionaries. So what this meant was raising a significant amount of money and getting people to donate. And primarily for the breakfast program, we're talking getting grocery stores that are usually owned by white business leaders to donate eggs and bacon and milk and orange juice and bread and sausage and everything else that goes into making breakfast for people. And so all over the United States, from New York and New Orleans to the Bay Area and Kansas City, large grocery store chains donated consistently to the Black Panther Party breakfast program. And we can see the same thing in their free shoes and free clothing and free medical care programs in various cities.
We've already heard from Bobby Seale. Huey Newton is another name that figures large in the history of the Black Panthers. Fred Hampton, though, figures large in your book and in your TEDx talk. What made Fred so notable?
Well, Fred was an amazing and very influential speaker. He was the leader of the Black Panther Party and the Illinois State chapter of the organization. Of course, he was based there in Chicago. But what made Fred Hampton so dangerous, in addition to his ability to convince people that there was injustice and to act on that injustice, he was able to convince people who were not black. So Students for Democratic Society, a number of Native American organizations, a number of organizations made of poor white people, made of Latino people, made of Asian people, all came together in what scholars are now calling the Rainbow Coalition. And so he was able to convince people that their problems had much less to do with race and the color of their skin than it did with the economic system under which they lived. That made him a very dangerous person because all of these ethnic groups were coalescing around the Panther program and creating their own breakfast programs, their own free health clinics, you know, instituting their own newspapers, and doing whatever it took in their communities to change the situation under which they lived. So to prevent this from having the success that it might have had, the government, the Chicago city government, the Illinois state government, the FBI conspired to murder Fred Hampton on the morning of December 4th, 1969. And they also murdered Mark Clark, who was the defense captain of the Peoria chapter, Peoria, Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. And, of course, they said they went into the apartment to check to see if there were illegal weapons inside the apartment. And, of course, there were no illegal weapons found.
Fred Hampton's family did sue the police. What happened?
They won. In 1982, the state of Illinois and Cook County was forced by a local judge there to pay nearly $2 million to the families of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton for wrongful death. Of course, most people consider it an assassination or murder, but the charge was wrongful death, and they were forced to pay nearly $2 million to these families.
We were talking about the Black Power movement, the Black Panther Party in particular, and civil rights more generally with Curtis Austin, an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon. He's our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was talking about the media reports, but, you know, the whole line about journalists is they write the first draft of history, but history can get skewed in similar ways as journalism, and it looks like the Black Panther Party doesn't really have control over its own history. What did you find out, Curtis, about the sources of information that are out there about the Black Panthers?
Well, it's very difficult to do research on the Black Panther Party. Lately, it's become a lot easier, and that's because Stanford University there in Palo Alto, California, now has an archive that is primarily something that came out of the numerous court trials that Huey Newton, the leader, had to endure. And so we get to see notes about different things that took place between the various chapters and headquarters there in Oakland. But for the average researcher, and I would say for most researchers, including myself, it's very difficult to get the information you need because historians usually rely on newspapers that kind of catalog what goes on day in, day out in any particular locale. And when you look at what was written about the Black Panther Party in newspapers between 1966 and, say, 1976, about a decade, what you find is three quarters of all the information in these newspapers have either been supplied by the FBI or written by the FBI or written by journalists that were friendly to the FBI. So Americans and people who read American newspapers like the New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times, are the major dailies in this particular country, really don't have an accurate sense of what the history of the Black Panther Party is if they are relying on what they see in these newspaper articles because they were completely skewed against the organization and anything positive they were trying to do.
Let's take a call here. We have Lorraine in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Curtis Austin from the University of Oregon. Go ahead, Lorraine.
Oh, hello. I didn't hear my name. Thank you. A new listener recently retired, and I just wanted to make a comment. I was in the field of disabilities and went to a conference in Oregon, and the keynote speaker was Eldridge Cleaver, and it was later in his life, and he had a son who had a disability. So that was his new passion. And I just found him to be quite engaging. And I didn't, you know, I was a teen in the 60s. So I heard of Eldridge Cleaver, but I thought it was very interesting to get to hang with him for about 3 days in Oregon.
And
That's all.
All right. Thanks for that, Lorraine. Appreciate it. So, I mean, the fact is that some of the original people are gone, but Eldridge Cleaver was still around then. Bobby Seale still around now. Are they able to get a more accurate story, do you think, Curtis, out about what the Black Panther Party was all about?
I think nowadays, because they are getting up in age, former members of the party are much more open to interviews. That's becoming more and more likely. And what we discover when we interview these people is they have some of the files that different chapters kept, chapters from Detroit to the ones in Winston-Salem, up in Baltimore, Seattle. These files are in the homes of people. And sometimes they share these files, they get digitized, they get put on the internet. The Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party is a very good example of this. You can just kind of Google that name and you'll see these digitized files that help you determine the history of the Panthers in Seattle. But I would just like to respond really quickly to the comment
sure.
of your caller, because in Oakland and San Francisco and Washington, D.C., in the late 60s and early 70s, and actually into the mid-70s, Black Panthers were involved in a campaign to get people with disabilities better and more services. And one of the things that campaign produced were the sidewalks that we've all become familiar with, where if you have crutches or a wheelchair or some other disability that won't allow you to access curbs very well, then these curbs are made flat or as ramps. Well, that came out of Black Panther Party activity.
Wow. That's a major accomplishment there. It seems like, though, in this day and age, in our time, the Panthers or the suggestion of Black Panthers still have some value for some white people to scare other white people. It seems like every presidential election, Fox News manages to find new Black Panthers or at least black men near polling places and put that on the air as if there's some intimidation going on.
Right. They're very good at that. And I think the incident you're referring to took place back east in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Where an individual who is a member of something called the New Black Panther Party I don't even know if he was arrested, but he was certainly taken to task outside of a voting poll for intimidation. Well, I can tell you that the New Black Panther Party and the Black Panther Party that we've been talking about this morning are two totally different entities. They have no connection other than the name. In fact, the old or let's say the original Black Panther Party has attempted to sue the New Black Panther Party for using its name and labeling it as an organization. They haven't been able to successfully do that, but there has been a major effort on the part of former members of the Black Panther Party from the 60s to get this New Black Panther Party not to use their organization's name.
Wow. So even a split from New Panthers and Old Panthers. We were talking about the appearance of the Panthers, the berets and the leather jackets. Beyonce and her group at the Super Bowl halftime show a few years ago wore outfits that mimic the Black Panther look and took a lot of heat for it. Does it surprise you that there's still such strong feelings about the Black Panthers?
You know, it really does not surprise me, because the Black Panther Party, unlike many organizations of the period, was able to attract the interest of not just black people, but young people of all colors, people of all faiths, people of various ethnic backgrounds. And so when you have someone with the influence and stature of a Beyonce who says to the world on a platform like Super Bowl halftime that this was an organization that is worth studying this was an organization that is worth mimicking, you can kind of begin to imagine that people who are interested in maintaining the status quo wouldn't want that message spread very wide. So she did, in fact, as you mentioned, take a lot of flack from that particular show, certainly for dressing up in black and having the afro and using the black power fist, if you would, as part of the choreography in the show. And it's just something that's attractive to young people and, in fact, to old people alike. And like I said, sometimes the people interested in maintaining status quo would rather those images not be out there. And so they have to do things to ensure that they have a negative connotation once it's too late to keep them from getting out there.
Well, while we're talking about people getting a flack on a football field, this brings up Colin Kaepernick and the other NFL players who have been taking a knee during the anthem. You know, it certainly reminded me of the Black Power salute of Tommy Smith and John Carlos on the medals podium at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, and raises the question again, what's so different now?
Well, for Colin Kaepernick, it's not very different at all. As we know, the two men who raised their fists in 1968 found it impossible to get a job when they got back to the United States. They were outcasts. And certainly the same thing has happened to Colin Kaepernick. Many sports experts will agree that he is at least as good as many quarterbacks that remain in the NFL, but he can't get a job on any team in the NFL. He's been castigated and lambasted in the press as if he were some type of terrorist. But of course, he is not, and was simply trying to raise awareness about what was going on in black communities, all in black and brown communities for that fact, all over the United States. Well, when you have that kind of platform, like the platform Beyonce had, like you're talking about now, the platform that Kaepernick has as a major NFL star, then that begins to influence people in ways that those who want to maintain the status quo don't want to see happen. So he lost his job as a result.
Curtis Austin has researched the civil rights movement, Black Power, Black Panthers. His book is Up Against the Wall, Violence in the Making and Unmaking of the Black Panther Party. He's done a lot of work in this field. He is an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon and this month's guest in our Curious Research Meets Radio segment. Dr. Austin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care.